G'day, and welcome to the Fremantle Press podcast. My name is Holden Shepherd, and today I'm talking to the incredible Madeleine Dickey. Madeleine and I would first of all today like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land we're meeting on for the podcast today, the Noongar people, and pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging. So, Madeleine Dickey has been writing since she was 7 years old. Her first novel, Troppo, was published by Fremantle Press in 2016. It won the City of Fremantle Hungerford Award and was shortlisted for the Dobby Literary Award and Barbara Jeffress Award. Red Can Origami is her second novel. It was written on Balangara country in the Kimberley region of Western Australia and at Yukobo Art Space in Tokyo, Japan. Madeleine loves to travel. A surf obsession has led her from Spain's Mundaka to Namibia's Skeleton Coast to little-known waves in the Dominican Republic. She is studying Spanish and speaks Indonesian. Madeleine currently lives in Exmouth, WA. Madeleine, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, hi Holden. Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
It's awesome to have you here. So let's jump in and talk about Red Can Origami. This is a brilliant book and it deals with the clash between so many different aspects of a small town. So you've got the native title group, you have a Japanese uranium mining company, and you've got, you know, the community of a small tropical town, all told through the eyes of a young and ambitious reporter, Ava. So I wanted to ask, first of all, I understand you wrote a lot of this novel in Wyndham, which is a small town up north, but what made you want to explore these themes around small town life in WA?
Yeah, so Red Can's the culmination of about 6 years of hard living, hard sweating, hard fishing and hard drinking in the Kimberley. I think as a writer, I tend to work with what I have around me. So that's why I guess I drew my inspiration from the country in the Kimberley. For those who haven't been to Wyndham, it's a really small town right at the very top of Western Australia. It has about 700 people and statistically it's known as the hottest town in Australia. So it's a pretty tough place to live. My husband Tom and I lived in one of the oldest homes in the Kimberley. It was one of the old Durack residences and it was completely open air down on the mud flat. We had air conditioning just in our bedroom but not in the rest of the house. And it was a pretty wild little place to live in. We had an outhouse out the back. So sometimes when we went to the toilet, there were pythons or green tree frogs in the toilet itself, which would jump up onto your bits in the night if you went for a wee, which is pretty terrifying. And the view from my writing desk, I used to write till about 10 every morning and then it would get too hot without air conditioning. But the view was out over these sort of mud flats, which filled up with water on high tides. And often saltwater crocodiles would end up in the culverts as well. Sort of in clean view from the writing desk. In the evening sometimes we were sort of down at Wyndham Port, so not too far from the old blood drain at the meatworks and near the Wyndham Hotel. And we were kind of nestled under a beautiful sort of mountain range that went orange and pink in the evenings. And some nights we'd sort of be sitting having a glass of wine, looking out over the mud flat and hear people up on the hills above us having a brass up. So shooting their guns at the stars. Wow. So this is very much kind of outback WA, small town living and a really fantastic place to work because it was a really lonely place. So often I think I would spend like a couple of weeks or maybe a week at a time if my husband was on country for work and I wouldn't talk to anybody. So although it was quite lonely, it was really, really good for writing. A great space to work on Red Can.
Yeah, it's interesting hearing you describe your experience in Wyndham because I feel like I've just lived it having read the book. Like it just feels so close to what is described in this novel. And something else that you talked about, because obviously what you just described is so much around nature and country and that permeates the whole novel really beautifully. And something else that kind of came from that is when you mentioned the loneliness aspect and how it feels to, you know, for people living in that kind of environment. It reminds me of something in the novel around, I think the character Ash says it, around there's, you know, there's two types of people up here. There's driftwood and there's deadwood. Does that come from that feeling of, you know, loneliness and that isolation?
Yeah, look, I think a little bit. I wasn't setting out to shape the characters as driftwood or deadwood. I think maybe some of the non-Indigenous characters in the book certainly fall into those categories. I think I was more sort of thinking about that Northern Australia, madmen, missionaries and mercenaries sort of attitude. And I guess on the loneliness aspect as well, my husband had a second uncle who lived not too far down the road in Kununurra. And once we asked him over for dinner, we said, oh, do you and the missus want to come for tea tonight? And he said, no way. the best view of Wyndham's in the rearview mirror. And that's a book, that's a line that comes out in the book as well. Also heard the town described as a sunny place for shady people. So it's a pretty wild little place to, live and to write.
It reminds me of my dad used to do a lot of work in Wiluna, and there used to be a sign in the pub there that said, "It's not the end of the earth, but you can see it from here."
Yeah.
So, what absolutely. A great way to just sum up your own town.
Yeah, absolutely. But I feel really fond. I have really fond memories of Wyndham, and I feel really good when I think about that place. It was a good place for me creatively.
Yeah. So tell me, I guess that leads in really nicely to the next question about, you know, you currently live up in Exmouth. You've lived in the Kimberley, now you're living in Exmouth, which is Pilbara, or is it Gascoyne?
Yeah, it's right on the top of the Gascoyne.
Yeah. So living in that kind of environment, how has that shaped your perspective of country and what that means?
Yeah, look, I think it's not so much about living in the environment, but working for native title groups and working for the mob has definitely changed the way that I look at country. In Redcan, I sort of unpack this a little bit. In the past, where I might have travelled to urban areas and identified myself within the built landscape by looking at certain features like a service station or, you know, the Woolies, IGA or a certain cafe, now I find myself looking at landscape in a really different way and looking at country in a different way. So, for example, in Redcan, the protagonist, Ava, she makes the observation on a trip over to the East Coast. She says, "Since you've been up north, your imagination ticks in unexpected ways. Through the window, you see ridgelines, gullies and soap trees. Passing through this sombre landscape of muted olives and greys, you wonder, what would be the best tide to fish the river on? What did the mob use for bait? Where are the women's places? Who knows the right songs for country? What are Wombrel and Woi Woi and Budgiewoi mean? It's as if this fresh map, thin as tissue paper, has been superimposed over your old way of knowing and relating to place." And so I think this is how, yeah, Ava's perspective is very much my own perspective of how my sense for country has changed after living in the north.
And it's a great, that excerpt is really a great example because you have this, you know, Ava's, you know, the city girl and she goes to live, you know, she's from Melbourne, I think, originally.
Yeah.
She goes to, you know, live in this small town. And then when she goes back to the urban environment, she's kind of thinking, well, I'm back to what I know. And actually, she's been, changed and fundamentally shifted.
Yeah, there has been a fundamental shift in perspective, for sure, without a doubt.
One of the things you did mention in that when you were answering the last question around native title, I wanted to ask a little bit about that if we could. Because it's I mean, in the context of the mining industry in particular, it's a core concern of this book and of Ava's work. And by the end of the book, through the lens of the character Noah, we get the sense that when it comes to working with mining corporations, local Aboriginal groups are pretty much damned if they do and damned if they don't. I understand you've had some experience working for native title groups. So what's going on? Like, what do you know and what do we need to know about this?
Yeah, so look, I think it's important to note that Noah's perspective, damned if you do, damned if you don't, is very much the perspective of the character in that book, not indicative of all of the mob anywhere in Australia. It's a really, you know, it sort of depends on the different groups and the different circumstances. I think the problem that's considered within Redcan is that the Native Title Act contains no right of veto for Aboriginal people when mining companies intend to open mines on Aboriginal land. And so this can result in no benefits potentially and a damaged environment. So that no veto over development was something I really wanted to look at. Redcan looks at the right to negotiate process under the Native Title Act, and this must be followed to ensure that certain future acts can be lawfully done. So the right to negotiate is negotiations between a proponent, like a mining company, and a native title group, and this applies to the grant of both exploration and mining tenements, unless the expedited procedure or fast-tracking process applies. So these were some of the things that kind of form that legal basis for the book. I'm not a lawyer, but I have spent the last 5 years doing some work in a media and communications capacity for an Aboriginal-owned legal company that has been involved with a lot of these developments. So I guess that's where my own sort of understanding of the issue comes in.
But I think that's really well done in the book as well, when you see, you know, the native title groups and their meetings with Gero Blue, which is the Japanese-owned mining company. And you've really evoked the kind of the powerlessness of this situation, like the fact that there is no power of veto For me as a reader, I was actually shocked because I thought, I assume that's part of what Native Title was about. And it's not.
And also, I guess, the passion as well that comes into those meetings. Yeah. I just can't imagine any other sort of meetings anywhere in the world where you're talking about country, you're talking about stories, you're talking about land, and it's so important. It means so much. And, yeah, that's sort of something that I wanted to unpack and maybe share with a wider audience.
I think you've done a really great job with that. I think this really brought a different perspective to the situation.
Yeah, thanks, Holden. I think on that note as well, I guess the reason I was really interested in writing about mining as a subject is that so many of my friends and, say, for example, when I was at university, I had friends who were studying geology or studying environmental science, and even then they were being headhunted by mining companies. Yep. And then the refrain was, oh, look, I'll just do it for a little while, get myself set up, and then I'll get out. So I think that we've all been impacted, whether we've worked directly in the industry or whether we've had sort of indirect benefits from what the mining industry has done for our economy. It's something that's really affected us all. And that's something I was really eager to explore.
Yeah, I think that's a great observation. And I think through the character of Ava and through her lens, you've explored that really effectively.
Yeah, because she jumps ship. She starts as a journalist but moves over. I needed to get her deep into the action.
And as a reader, you're kind of sitting there going, well, yeah, why wouldn't you? I mean, you're being treated like crap at your job and you're trying to do the right thing, but it's not working and you're not being seen for doing the right thing. So maybe you can help from the inside.
Yeah.
And actually it's so disillusioning once she's on the inside as well.
Yeah.
So really, really well done. There's also the other aspect, I guess, to this, which is not just from the Native Title's perspective, but the Japanese perspective.
Yeah.
And you actually travelled to Japan as part of writing this novel, not just to Japan. I can't wait to hear about this. You went to a nuclear exclusion zone.
Yeah.
What was that like?
Well, I'll start with the Japan bit. I was really lucky to get an AsiaLink arts residency to travel to Yokobo Art Space. And I had two months just working on Redcan during that time. I may have lied a little bit on that application for the residency.
It's okay. No one's listening. It's just a podcast.
I said I could speak Japanese. And I figured that but if I got the funding, that. I thought, how hard could Japanese be? And then I got the funding.
So what happened? Did you have to do night classes?
Yeah, I signed up for a first year uni course by correspondence in Wyndham and, yeah, didn't realise that there were three alphabets and
kanji's really hard.
I think you need at least 2,000 or 3,000 kanji characters to read a newspaper.
Yeah.
So anyway, that didn't go so well. But the experience of the residency was fantastic and it put me in touch with other artists who I actually learned of an art installation within the nuclear exclusion zone. It's like the most difficult to access art installation in the world.
Mm.
So being at that residency, I had fantastic hosts and they put me in touch with the Japanese arts community, which was really exciting. I travelled to Manami Soma City maybe 4 weeks into the residency and that was affected quite heavily by airborne radiation. 60,000 people were evacuated from the city.
Which disaster was this? This was the Fukushima Daiichi?
Yeah, that's right. So that there was a massive earthquake which caused a tidal wave which hit the reactors and then affected the backup diesel generators. So that caused the accident. And then radiation was sort of airborne and affected just a huge part of the surrounding area. And so I travelled by bus from Manami Soma City to Fukushima City through parts of the nuclear exclusion zone, which were titled difficult to return zones. So there were places that were too radioactive, too poisonous for people to live.
Oof.
And basically 5 or 10 kilometres out of Manami Soma City, I saw the first bags of radioactive topsoil. So people had gone through to bag up the radioactive soil. And this was 6 years after the disaster and it was sitting there in the fields. So the highway had sort of Geiger counters along it. There were no people, no crops in the fields. These sort of untended shrines just getting slowly swallowed by the trees again. It was really, really eerie and just gave me such a sense for the scale of the disaster because it was Australian uranium that fueled Fukushima Daiichi. And so in a sense, there is kind of a level of responsibility there. And when I was writing Redcan, I very much had in my mind the words of Yvonne Margarula of the Mirarr people in the Northern Territory. She wrote a letter to Ban Ki-moon, who was the former Secretary General of the UN, and she wrote, "Given the long history between Japanese nuclear companies and Australian uranium miners, it is likely that the radiation problems at Fukushima are, at least in part, fueled by uranium derived from our traditional lands. This makes us feel very sad." And this was really at the core of Redken Origami, this idea that it's Australian uranium from traditional lands.
And that's something that is explored in terms of how disastrous or how much of an impact nuclear, you know, not fallout necessarily, but, you know, tailings ponds, you know, if they spill and leak, that itself can destroy the environment.
Yeah, absolutely. And in Redken, the mine is more or less modelled on Ranger and the whole lot of kind of various incidents and accidents that have occurred there, like kids in the Northern Territory building radioactive castles out of mud. Or in one of the tailings dams, I think at one stage an island grew in the middle of the dam where it wasn't covered by the water. There's so many stories about problems there. So I think some of the newer uranium mines don't even use the terminology tailings dam. But as I was doing some quick last-minute research to make sure everything was tight for Redken, but in the book it's modelled on Ranger, which is a much older mine.
And it was interesting what you said in talking about uranium, you know, Aussie uranium has fueled, you know, the Japanese nuclear reactors. They've had a disaster. So there's some kind of implication that we're, you know, perhaps responsible or that we're party to it in some way. And I thought that was really interesting around the way the novel is written. So the actual perspective, the narration is second person. And it's a really evocative use of you. And, you know, the second person, and I don't often see that done so well as I did in this novel. And I feel, and, you know, we talked about this a little bit earlier, around the use of that and why that was done, not just to put the person into, you know, Ava's shoes, but perhaps is there a link there to that responsibility?
Yeah, definitely not at first. At first, I just finished reading Patrick DeWitt's awesome book, Ablutions, and I was really jealous and I wanted to copy it.
I want to do that.
Yeah, I thought, oh my goodness, that's amazing. And I just started the book in second person after I started the book in second person, and it seemed to just have a rhythm and an energy and a pace of its own. It was sort of almost like the sentences were writing themselves. I don't know how to explain it better than that, but there was just...
No, there's something hypnotic about it, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. Totally hypnotic. So that's how it started. As the book and the themes of the book fleshed out and as it grew, I guess then I thought that the you does have implications of responsibility. I didn't want this to be in a really heavy didactic sense, more like in a subtle kind of soft sense. But as Ava, the you, is non-Aboriginal, she's a gadia, she's a white fella, it almost is addressing non-Aboriginal readers to say you are responsible for more than just yourself, more than just your career, just getting into the mining industry for a few years and then getting out once you set yourself up. You're responsible for calling out racism when you hear it, and you're responsible for the ongoing impacts of colonisation. And that's obviously another important facet to the book. It's the shift between the colonisation of the pastoral industry to a new kind of colonisation through the mining industry.
And that's explored so well through the difference between the pastoralists and the, you know, the white Namibian character, which we probably we won't go into, and, you know, the Watanabe sons of the world who are, you know, taking over in a corporate sense.
Yeah, I was thinking about this on the way here actually, and in a way, I think the white Namibian is a wolf. And Watanabe-san is a sheep in a wolf's clothing.
Yes.
A wolf in a sheep's clothing.
Yes, yeah, no, I agree.
Maybe, because they're both really quite, you know, representing those forms of colonisation at heart. And I couldn't differentiate, which is worse.
No, that's such a good description, though, because you do have someone who's, you know, the white Namibian is like kind of obviously like a villain.
A villain,
And Watanabe-san, you're like, maybe he's very philosophical about it. Maybe he's just being pragmatic and maybe he does have their interests at heart, but you're like, no, he totally doesn't.
Yeah.
It's really well done. So I thought that use of you was a really fantastic device that you used. You've also used a lot of Kimberley Creole in terms of the dialogue in the book. And I know your first novel, Tropo, used a lot of Indonesian. Is this a recurring theme in your work? Is it completely coincidental? Is it just a byproduct of living in different places when you're writing these books?
Yeah, look, I think for Red Can, the Kimberley Creole was more about making the story true to place so that the rhythms of the Kimberley were really in there. And I worked with a Kimberley linguist to make sure what I had in there was accurate. But it's difficult because Red Can is mostly set in a fictional town, which is more or less Broome.
I guessed it was Broome. That's so cool.
Yeah, so there's parts of Wyndham that kind of come into the surrounding country and the surrounding stories, but it's Gubbinge is more or less Broome. But the Broome Creole is really different to the Creole in the Fitzroy Valley or to the Creole in Halls Creek or out on the Tanami. So, and it's a really difficult, it was really difficult to put it in the book because it's an oral language, so there's not very much written about it. So you can't sort of check the spelling of words. And so that was really tough. On the other hand, I use a lot of Indonesian in Tropo, but that's for a really different purpose. I wanted my readers of Tropo to feel that total sense of dislocation that you get when you're traveling in a different country and you don't understand the language. I wanted that to add to the sense of discomfort and unease that you feel, and that spooky sort of sense of things being a little bit out of your control, as they are for Petty, the protagonist of Tropo. So I think they're the reasons that I've used the language in each book respectively.
And I noticed it must have been interesting to go back and forth, because I noticed in your acknowledgements you you talked about, look, there were some things that you agreed with your advisor on and other things you went, no, it's more like this, I guess because it was based in Broome as opposed to Wyndham. So you had to make those judgment calls.
Yeah, I kind of wanted to, I didn't want to be specific about a town either though, because that way you're sort of anchored to that particular geography. And I didn't want anyone to say, oh, that's this native title group or that native title group. And then that's wrong, we don't do that. So I wanted to keep it really generic in that sense to avoid those sort of pitfalls of misrepresenting culture.
Gives you so much more leeway to,
yeah,
to fictionalise
it's fiction.
It. Yeah,
it's fiction.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
One of the things you were talking about is that you didn't want to be heavily didactic. And I think you avoided that really well. So I mean, the book does deal with a lot of heavy themes. It deals with these, you know, country, loss of country, the mining and the environmental impacts of that, belonging, kind of Ava's sense of where she belongs. But I never thought it was heavy-handed. I thought it was dealt with in a really great way. I think part of that is that there was so much in there. I know we've talked kind of extensively about how kind of heavy this is, but there's so much humour. It was really fun, and you made it, you didn't try to tell us what to think. You kind of laid it out there, and that makes it so much more effective. Did you kind of intentionally inject, you know, humour in the book to represent kind of what, you know, what country people are like, you know?
Not deliberately, I don't think. But I mean, when you live in the bush, that hard sort of dry humour that's so specific to WA as well, I think it's just a really important part of everyday life. And it does, it lightens it. But then I guess when you're living in the north, there is that light and shade. And so I guess in the book, I don't know, there's lots of sort of lines like, you know, this isn't a fishing hole, it's a shithole. Or there's a scene where a guy on one of the boats sticks his, is busting for a wee, but he doesn't want a wee on the pilot who's in the boat with him because the pilot's pretty straight. So he puts his dick in a bottle to wee in the bottle, and then it swells up and he can't get the bottle off. That's a true story that happened to my husband, Tom.
Oh, no.
I'm not sure how he feels about the representation of himself in that particular scene. But, yeah, I think it's important to have that sort of that light, because there is a lot of fun.
There's an unpreciousness to it, right?
Yeah, and we've got a wicked sense of humour. I think we're really good at taking the piss out of each other, and that's important.
Totally. It took me back, you know, I'm from Jero, and not Jero Blue, which is the mining company in this book, but Geraldton. And it, you know, it does give you that sense of, this is how I grew up. You know, like, this is, people are very unprecious. The game of Swagmo, can you please explain that? Because I saw that, so I read the acknowledgements first. I sometimes do that.
Yeah.
And so I saw this, you credited someone, one of your mates, with creating Swagmo. And I was like, what the hell is Swagmo? And then I got into the book and I thought, this is hilarious.
Yeah. Well, he got a bit up. He was like, I don't know if I really made it up. I heard some people in the Northern Territory play this as well, but I think our version was quite unique. He'd just come back from Japan, and so what you do is you open up a swag, someone lies in the swag and gets strapped in, and you can't stand up when you have a swag on you, so your mates need to lift you to your feet, and then you go one-on-one. So you set up a ring, and then the person who wins is the first person to knock the other person out of the ring. So that was swagmo. I think when you're playing that as a 30-year-old pretending that you're a teenager. The first night that swagmo came about was a night in Derby, actually, a wild night, and one of the guys who just started working at the Kimberley Land Council split his head open on an esky. Blood went everywhere. And I think that's in the
I think that's how that scene
how
ends.
That game ends.
Yeah. You're like, yeah, no, okay, no more swagmo.
Yeah.
But I just thought it was such a great addition. Now, can I ask a couple of kind of processy, writery questions, if that's okay?
Go for it. Yeah.
I know one of the things I love doing this podcast for is that I get to like meet amazing authors and just like pick their brains for my own game.
For sure.
So I know your first book, Tropo, won the Hungerford Award in 2014 mm-hmm. and published in 2016. And then this is your second novel. I wondered how did it compare in terms of process, but also having won accolades and, you won the Hungerford, you were shortlisted for other awards. Was there a pressure? Was there expectation in the follow-up?
Okay, so a couple of parts to that question. How did they sort of compare to start with? Redcan was pretty tricky. At the start, I thought it would be a nonfiction book. And so I had written 22,000 words. So for me, that's about a third of a draft of a nonfiction book. And it was between our stints in Broome and in Wyndham. So my husband and I took 3 months off to travel in the Dominican Republic and Costa Rica and Panama. And I remember thinking, that's it, I'm going to get stuck into this book. I'm going to knock it over on this trip. And we went down, we're in the Dominican Republic, and we went to a tiny little town on the coast, which was idyllic, absolutely beautiful. My husband Tom would go down to swim laps while I go down and drink margaritas and write.
I have shades of Ava in the drinking of margaritas. Yeah,
I think actually when Tom was swimming laps on one day, he counted 5 pairs of undies underwater, and that's because it was a sex town.
Oh.
So it was full of these old Russian blokes with beautiful Dominican whores on their arms, with huge afros, great legs, good high heels. So it was a really unusual sort of setup. And I remember very clearly the day that I sat down to this 22,000 words and realized that the whole lot was rubbish and it was heartbreaking. So that's where I ditched that. And on that trip, actually, when we were in Costa Rica, Redcan in the second person in its current form started. And once I got going with that, then there was no stopping. It was really a much smoother process than Tropo. I think more broadly speaking, and particularly for any writers out there who are looking to get their first book up, what I would sort of recommend, I guess what my own process is, which you might be able to take something from this, but I'll usually write a first draft and then leave it for a couple of months. I'll look at it again, write a second draft based on any changes that I think need to happen. I'll then give it to my friends. And then these are sort of trusted readers. So you don't want people who are like, oh, Matt, that's such a great book. I love this. No, you want people who are going to be hard with you, who will just really be analytical and slam the book where it's not working. I'll then rewrite a game based on this, and then usually I pay for a manuscript assessment. And this was really valuable, not so much in Redcan, but certainly for Tropo.
Yes.
So I had a lady over East give me the manuscript assessment for Tropo, and she had real problems with the character of Penny. So this is what she wrote about an early version of Penny. There is a real problem with the character of Penny, who often seems flighty and superficial, sometimes unlikable, not trustworthy as a narrator, and not a person whose judgment the reader would accept. She is naive, vain, selfish, has a bad temper, and lacks the capacity to reserve her own judgment silently. I thought it was such a great book. And I thought, oh, this manuscript assessment, she's going to love it. She'll say, yep, get this in for that award, get this in here. And no way, she absolutely tore it to pieces. And I rewrote the book based on that assessment and submitted it for the City of Fremantle Hungerford Award and was successful. Wow. I think with Redcan, I actually added an extra step in. So after the manuscript assessment, I paid someone for a line edit just to make sure. And a line edit is different to a proofread. It's where you look at whether there's sort of words repeated in the same sentence and how the sentences fit together.
Yes.
Almost like fitting tiles together, like each sentence has to be sort of perfect.
Yeah, they tessellate, don't they?
Yeah, exactly, and how it fits within the paragraphs. And then I did maybe another proofread before submitting Redcan to Fremantle Press. Once it gets picked up by the press, as you know, Holden, there's another rewrite. So in the case of Redcan, there was a big structural edit and I had to rewrite the ending. So the ending is different to my original ending.
Interesting.
And then we looked at another, probably another two-line edits followed by another two or three proofreads. So if my maths is correct, both books are about the product of 10 drafts. So I guess if you're a first-time writer and you finish that first draft and just think, that's it, I'm done, like I did with Troppo, I sent it off to a publisher, not finished. And they said, this is not quite... I was so excited and I had just had no idea that the first draft, you're not even halfway.
No, you're not. It's just the shoveling the sand into the sandpit and then you got to build the sandcastle from there.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
It's not mine. I stole it from Twitter. But it's kind of something that stuck with me and it seems to kind of sit with how you process your writing as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think writing fiction is harder than nonfiction. Mm-hmm. I think nonfiction, you sort of have the facts in front of you and you sculpt that into something beautiful. But writing fiction, you sort of sit down at the desk each day with a blank piece of paper and you have to make it up, invent.
Yeah.
And that's really, really hard.
Yeah, no pressure.
Yeah. On the pressure, I didn't feel pressure with Redcan.
I was kind of, if you can't tell, like asking that from like a selfish perspective because you know, you come from that place where you've had, you know, your first book has won an award and we're Hungerford winners, both of us. Yep. And I'm like, oh my God, the next one has to be just as good. Otherwise everyone will hate me and hate it. And it's interesting to hear you just go, no.
I didn't with Redcan, but I do with book three.
Really?
So I'm flying out to Mexico tomorrow night.
As you do.
As you do. I've been really lucky to get two pools of funding from the Department of Cultural Industries, WA, and an Ignite Copyright Agency grant to work on my third book, which is a return to the surfing theme. Mm-hmm. So it's a surf noir thriller set between Western Australia and Mexico. At this stage, it's about localism and violence. And it hinges on how far the locals in a small WA community will go to guard their waves from outsiders. So it is about a young backpacker who puts a video of a secret wave up on Instagram. She's maybe an influencer.
And
she's murdered for sharing the video. So it's crime.
Wow. So is it because it's a new genre for you that you're kind of
Sure. I worry that it's too shallow. I mean, Redcan is such a big book. It's huge in scope. The ideas are really big. I'm just a bit worried that maybe it's not as, and I mean, is it okay then to write books that fall into that more entertainment sort of category than serious fiction? So I think that's where my fear is coming from.
Yeah. And is your audience going to accept
that sort of shifted?
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So I guess we'll see. I'm really hoping for a very creative 3 months in Mexico ahead.
I'm sure it will be. I'm sure you get a lot of surfing done as well.
I'm sure I will.
Fit that in there somewhere. Look, good luck with book three. But I think maybe to finish off today, it would be really great if we could have a reading from Redcan Origami, if that's something you're happy to share.
I would really, really love to. So I've rewritten this a little bit just for presentation.
Oh, wow.
So this isn't really in the book, but it sort of is. This is a scene where one of the main characters, Noah, he's an Aboriginal boss. He's also a bull rider and he's competing at the rodeo.
Yes.
So he's about to step into the ring for the final bull ride of the night.
Awesome scene. Over to you, Madeleine Dickey.
The MC continues. Before we go on, just a bit of housekeeping. See that car coming here now? The one with the flashing blue light on top? That's the cheapest taxi in WA. There are hoots from the drinking area. Nah, seriously though, anyone drinking their own terps outside the designated area, you'll be getting a free ride down to the station. Now, for the last ride of the night, we've got Noah Ishikawa from Devil's Gorge. The cheer for Noah lasts a good 5 seconds. Everyone knows him. Everyone fills their lungs to shout their support. There are even a few wolf whistles. Now, Noah's going to be riding Terminator, one of Graham De Beer's savage big hamburgers. Sorry to say, Noah, but you've definitely drawn a short straw here. The crowd falls silent at this. There are gasps, murmurs, fear. So kids, get away from the bloody sides of the fence or you'll know about it. Terminator explodes from the gate, a brute of a bull, twice as big as the others, a mass of unlikely, ungainly muscle. The bull spins once at lightning speed and Noah hangs on, a dark bloom of blood in both his cheeks. It spins again and you read the acute concentration in the frown line between Noah's eyes. It spins a third time and the MC screams, 5 seconds! Then the bull swaps spins for an athletic lunge. It's tipping sideways. It's heaving Noah toward the dirt. The angles are impossible, but Noah hangs on. 6 seconds! Then finally, furiously, Terminator plants his front hooves in the dirt and corkscrews his back legs and torso in the air. Noah slips. You watch, horrified, as a hoof crushes down on his neck.
You've been listening to Madeleine Dickey reading from her brand new novel, Red Can Origami. Such a fantastic scene, the rodeos and the fishing in this book really bring it, they really bring it to life. It's absolutely fantastic. It has been so much fun talking to you about Red Can Origami and about your writing. So thanks so much for coming in today for the podcast. Good luck with book 3. And Red Can Origami is out when?
Red Can's coming out this December with Fremantle Press, and I'm really, really excited. Holden, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks so much, Madeleine. It's an absolute pleasure.